Good morning, everyone, and Richard, thank you for that introduction and the invitation to be at your conference today. It's fantastic for me to be able to visit Toowoomba, and I'm here to learn more about what's going on in the farm sector and in regional Australia. I knew about Toowoomba from a fairly early age because I grew up in Wagga in southern New South Wales, and at the time Wagga lay claim to the biggest inland city in New South Wales. So one of those childhood facts that you learn, I kind of wanted to know what the competition was. And Toowoomba was part of the competition. And so from an early age, I knew that Toowoomba was the biggest inland city in Queensland. So it's great to be finally here. As we all know, the past year has been an extremely challenging one in the life of our nation. But as a country, we pull together and we've been up to the task. And the results of that are evident in the health and the economic outcomes, which are better than they are elsewhere in the world. I think it's really important that we don't lose sight of that. This morning, I would like to talk about how the economy is now transitioning from recovery mode to expansion mode. And I want to highlight some of the issues that this raises, including for regional Australia. I will then conclude with some comments about the outlook for monetary policy. Back in March last year, the National Economic Strategy quickly turned to building a bridge to the day when the virus was contained. The idea was to use that bridge to help people and businesses get across to the other side. The hope was that by doing this, we could avoid much of the costly damage that would be caused by mass unemployment and large-scale business failures. In my view, this was the right strategy. It was supported by governments across Australia, supported by the Reserve Bank, and by Australia's financial institutions, and the results speak for themselves. Today, the level of employment in Australia is above its pre-pandemic level. So you can see this in my first chart. Australia and New Zealand are the only advanced economies where this is the case. In the United States, for example, employment is still 5% below its pre-pandemic level. You can see in Spain and Italy, it's 3 and 4% below the previous level of employment. That's a big difference. A lot more people in Australia have jobs relative to the previous situation than any other Western country. The GDP data also point a positive picture of the recovery. You can see here the recovery has been V-shaped. The level of output in Australia is now above its pre-pandemic level. Not many other countries can say that. The bounce back has been quicker and it's been stronger than we expected last year. Back in August, we didn't expect the previous level of output to be regained before the first half of 2022. Yet here we are, early in 21, we've already bounced back to the previous level of employment of output. It's a remarkable achievement. There's also been a sharp V-shaped recovery in farm output, as you would know. After the devastating drought, farm output is up 40% since the middle of last year. It's at a record high. Rural exports are also at a record high. This recovery in the farm sector is positive news not only for those in the industry and the communities that support it, but it's also making a valuable contribution to the recovery in the national economy. As positive as these outcomes are, it's important not to lose sight of the fact that we're still in the recovery phase. Our international borders are still largely closed. Outbreaks of the virus are still leading to periodic lockdowns, and many firms are still adjusting to changes in how people spend their money and where they work in their supply chains. It's also worth recalling that the economic recovery is still being underpinned by unprecedented fiscal and monetary policy measures, and these should not and cannot last forever. So we still have a way to go before the recovery is complete. It's time, though, to be thinking about how we transition from recovery mode to expansion mode and consider some of the issues that will affect that transition. And I'd like to touch on three of these this morning. The first is how household balance sheets evolve in light of the substantial change. The first is how household spending evolves in light of the substantial changes in household balance sheets over the past year. The second is the tightening of the labour market and its implications for wages and prices. And the third is the need for further productivity growth. So first, to household balance sheets. One of the standout features of the past year was the large increase in household saving. As you can see here, in June last year, the household saving rate spiked to 22%, which is the highest level that it's been in history. This increase in saving reflected the combination of the boost to incomes from government support, the limited opportunities that people had to spend during lockdowns, and households feeling uncertain about the future. When people are uncertain, they tend to save more. While the saving rate has since declined as restrictions have eased, you can see here it remains high by historical standards. The fact that households have saved more means that in aggregate, household balance sheets are in better shape than they were before the pandemic. Household balance sheets have also been affected by the recent rise in housing prices. This rise is a nationwide development, but it was first seen in parts of regional Australia, with price gains in many regional centres outstripping those in the capital cities, as you can see in this chart. Global factors, including low interest rates, have played an important role here. But there's also been strong demand for properties in regional Australia due to people moving out of the capital cities to regional Australia and fewer people leaving regional centres to move to the city during the pandemic. The effects of this are evident not just in housing prices, but also in rental markets as well, with rents rising very quickly in many regional centres, including here in Queensland. How households respond to these changes in their balance sheets will help shape the next stage of the recovery. If households were to run down their additional savings quickly, or if higher housing prices spurred more spending than usual, a stronger economic path than the one we have envisaged would eventuate. But on the other hand, it is possible that households sit on these extra savings for a long time and they restrain their spending because of uncertainty about the pandemic and their health. And if that were to be the case, it would obviously slow the recovery. So this is an area we're watching very carefully. It's also worth noting that the rise in housing prices is encouraging more housing construction. I think the challenge here is to make sure that the planning process is sufficiently flexible to allow the supply side of the market to respond to this extra demand. Regional centres should be better placed to respond on the supply side in the capital cities, although I understand that's not always the case. A related challenge here is to find the workers to build the new housing in regional Australia. And this is an issue I'll return to in a few moments. The other aspect of the housing market we're paying close attention to is the increase in household borrowing. The RBA does not, and it should not, target housing prices. We do, though, have a strong interest in trends in household borrowing, especially given the already high level of household debt in Australia. It's important that lending standards remain sound in an environment of low interest rates and rising housing prices. At its meeting last week, the Council of Financial Regulators also discussed the risk that could arise if growth in household borrowing substantially outpaced growth in household income. At the moment, we're not in that situation. But the Council did discuss possible policy responses to a scenario in which rapid growth in household debt posed heightened risks to the future stability of our economy. So we're going to keep a very close eye on this risk and trends in household borrowing. I'd now like to turn to the second issue, and that's the labour market. The recovery here has been much stronger than we anticipated. The result is that the national unemployment rate fell to 5.5% in April. That's just a little higher than it was before the pandemic. Job vacancies, job ads, and hiring intentions are also very strong. Given this, we're expecting the unemployment rate to trend lower over the months ahead, with our central scenario being that the unemployment rate declines to around 4.5% by the end of next year. This improvement in the labour market is especially evident in many regional communities. As you can see in this chart, for the first time in many decades, unemployment in regional Australia is noticeably lower than it is in the capital cities. Of course, there's still a lot of variation across regions, but the average unemployment rate for regional Australia as a whole is the lowest it's been in more than a decade. Despite this, our labour market remains uneven. Many people are still struggling to find work, while at the same time, some firms are reporting they're struggling to find workers. Many of these reports from businesses are from regional Australia, including businesses in the agricultural, hospitality, mining, construction sectors. And in nationwide business surveys, many firms are now saying that finding suitable labour is a major constraint on output. Notwithstanding these signs of a tightening labour market, wages growth and inflation remain subdued, and unlike the real side of the economy, there have not been upside surprises on wages and prices. As you can see here, the wage price index increased by just 1.5% over the past year, with wage growth slowing both the public and the private sectors. And it's noteworthy that even in those pockets where firms are finding it hardest to hire workers, wage increases are mostly modest. There are some exceptions to this, and wages are rising quickly for a couple of occupations, but these exceptions are still fairly isolated. This experience speaks to a broader dynamic in the economy that's been evident for some time and that's contributing to subdued wage and price outcomes. Most businesses feel like they're operating in a very competitive marketplace and they have little ability to raise prices. As a result of this, understandably, there's a laser-like focus on costs. If profits can't be increased by expanding or by raising prices, then it has to be achieved by lowering costs. This has become the predominant mindset of many businesses in Australia. This mindset can be helpful in making the businesses more efficient, but it also has the effect of making wages and prices less responsive to economic conditions. In my view, this mindset became more entrenched during the resources boom when the exchange rate appreciated to high levels. When one Australian dollar was worth more than one US dollar, many Australian businesses felt that their Australian dollar cost structure was simply too high. You might recall that through this period, many businesses were saying that Australian costs, including labour costs, were leaving them uncompetitive. This experience has left a lasting imprint on many businesses, and it's reinforced the narrative in Australia about the importance of cost control. Against this background, the economy is now recovering from the pandemic, and some firms are finding themselves facing labour shortages. At least some of these businesses face a choice. Do they increase wages in an effort to attract new employees and perhaps put up their prices? Or do they pursue another strategy? Many firms are choosing the second option, relying on non-wage strategies to retain and attract staff. Some are also adopting a wait and ration approach. Wait until labour market conditions ease, perhaps when the borders reopen, and until then, ration output. For some, this is a better option than paying higher wages and driving up their own cost base. This is especially so if the increases in the cost base are difficult to reverse later on, there's a reluctance to raise prices, and the business expects that labour market conditions will ease before too long, perhaps when the borders open. But by waiting and by rationing, they can avoid entrenching a higher cost structure in their business in response to a problem that they hope will only be temporary. The underlying point here is that there are a range of factors that are contributing to limited upward pressure on wages, even in tight labour markets. I've previously talked about the effects of globalisation, about technology and changes in industrial relations arrangements. There's always a degree of uncertainty about the future, but we're not expecting the influence, of these various factors to wane quickly. Some are structural in nature, and others will not be overcome until a tight national labour market is sustained for some time. As I will discuss shortly, our monetary policy strategy is designed to achieve this. I think it's noteworthy, and it's also a positive development, that fiscal policy is also seeking to achieve a lower unemployment rate in Australia. I'd now like to turn to the third issue that will shape the expansion, and that's productivity growth. Earlier I spoke about how the economic strategy during the early days of the pandemic was to build a bridge to the other side. On the fiscal front, that bridge was built by governments borrowing against future national income to support households and businesses in the here and now. This was the right thing to do. It was affordable, and the higher level of public debt that's resulted from this is manageable. The stronger our future national income is, the more this strategy makes sense. And it's for this reason that I've raised the issue of productivity growth. The best response to higher debt levels is stronger growth in future national income, underpinned by a more productive economy. Over the past year, our national income has once again been boosted by the higher prices for our exports. As you can see in this chart, Australia's terms of trade, so this is our export prices relative to our import prices, are now approaching the once-in-a-century peak reached during the resources boom just a decade ago. It's a remarkable outcome. There's been a lot of focus on the price of iron ore, but the prices of many agricultural commodities have also increased very substantially. Since the start of 2019, wheat prices have increased 15%, beef prices are up 20%, and lamb prices are up by more than 25%. The prices of canola, sugar, and cotton have also increased sharply over the past year. This has been widespread increases in the prices of our exports, and this is boosting our national income. But ultimately, it's a more productive economy that will form the basis of sustainable increases in future national income. As has been well documented, labour productivity growth in Australia was slowing prior to the pandemic, and you can see that in this next chart. The reasons for this slowing in productivity growth are complex and they're not fully understood. But it's likely that the slowing is related to the subdued level of investment over recent times. From this perspective, it was pleasing to see a pickup in business investment in the recent national accounts. Machinery and equipment investment increased by 10% in the March quarter, and it was particularly strong in manufacturing, construction, retail and the farm sectors. Many firms were responding to significant government incentives that have been put in place. The farm sector really has been at the forefront of this pickup in investment. You can see this here with tractor sales surging to record highs over the past year. This pickup in investment is welcome, but we do have a fair way to go to reverse the decline in investment over the past decade. If we are to build the capital stock that's needed for a more productive economy and a durable expansion, we're going to need to see a further lift in business investment. This lift should be possible, as there are investment needs and opportunities in many areas of our country. The government has rightly identified the digital economy as one of these areas. The farm sector knows this, with some exciting opportunities in the area of ag tech. Ongoing investment in infrastructure and human capital is also required. Further investment is also needed in the energy sector, where technology is evolving quickly, as are the attitudes of international investors. The changes in the global energy system are opening up a new source of comparative advantage for Australia. So there are opportunities here. But we will need more investment to capitalise on this new source of comparative advantage, and much of this investment will be in regional Australia. How will we do this will have a significant bearing on our future national income and on the shape of the ongoing expansion. I'd now like to turn to monetary policy, which has played an important role in building the bridge that I spoke about earlier. The RBA's actions have led to the lowest funding costs on record, a banking system that's flush with liquidity, and very low bond yields. Our actions have also meant that the exchange rate is lower than it otherwise would have been, and they've helped strengthen household and business balance sheets. And this has been our contribution to the recovery in jobs and economic activity in Australia. At the Reserve Bank Board's next meeting, we have two important decisions to make. The first is whether or not to extend the yield target from the April 2024 bond to the next bond, which matures in November 24. And the second is whether, and in what form, to extend the bond purchase program once the current program is completed in September. The three-year yield target was introduced in March 2020 during an exceptional period. Our judgment is that it has been a successful monetary policy response, which has helped keep funding costs low and reinforced our forward guidance about interest rates. At the time the target was introduced, the three-year government bond had a maturity date in early 23. At that time, the board recognised that the pandemic would require an extended period of very accommodative monetary policy. Reflecting this, the board's view was that the probability was extremely low that the conditions for an increase in the cash rate would be met within 3 years, and adopting a three-year yield target reinforced that message. Now, with the passage of time, the three-year government bond has a maturity date of April 24, and a few months' time the maturity date would move to the November 24 bond. In considering whether or not to extend the target to the November 24 bond, the central issue is again the probability of the cash rate increasing over a three-year window. In this context, the board has reviewed a range of possible scenarios. In some of these, the conditions for an increase in the cash rate could be met during 2024, while in other scenarios these conditions would not be met. And the board will again review these scenarios at our meeting in a few weeks' time. The bond purchase program has also been an important part of the RBA's monetary policy response. By purchasing bonds, we've lowered bond yields and funding costs across the economy, and we've contributed to a lower exchange rate than otherwise, and this has helped the rural sector. With the current bond purchase program to be completed in September, the board has been working through a range of options for what comes next. These options include, first, ceasing the bond purchases in September. Second, repeating the current $100 billion purchase program over a similar timeframe to that of the current program. Third, scaling back the amount purchased or spreading the purchases out over a longer period. And fourth, moving to an approach where the pace of bond purchases is reviewed more frequently based on the flow of data and on the economic outlook. We've made no decisions yet, other than to rule out the first option. That's the cessation of bond purchases in September. The RBA's bond purchase program is one of the factors that's underpinning the accommodative financial conditions necessary for the economic recovery. So it would be premature to be considering ceasing bond purchases in the near term. The key consideration here is how the RBA can best support the ongoing recovery of the economy. The board wants to see the recovery transition into strong and durable economic growth, with low unemployment and faster growth in wages than we've seen recently. Over time, this will help deliver the inflation target. As part of the board's overall strategy, it will not increase the cash rate until inflation is sustainably within the 2-3% target range. Year-ended CPI inflation will temporarily spike in the June quarter to around 3.5% due to the unwinding of some pandemic-related price reductions. There have also been price increases for some items due to pandemic-related interruptions to supply. But beyond this, inflation pressures remain subdued, and they're likely to remain so. for inflation to be sustainably in the 2-3% range, wage increases will need to be materially higher than they have been recently. Partly for the reasons I talked about earlier, this still seems some way off. But thank you very much for listening, and I'd be happy to answer some questions. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you for that. Really broad range of topics covered there, and really glad that you addressed so much of the issues with regional Australia and agricultural commodities. I might just start with the first question, just around that regionalisation issue at the moment, in terms of the shortage in the labour market, rents increasing. We are seeing a lot of regional stimulus coming from governments. Do you think it's well targeted to address some of those issues?
I don't know enough about the details to know how well it's targeted, but it's a good problem to have, isn't it? For many years, I remember the discussion in many regional communities was that people were leaving the communities and moving to the cities because there weren't their opportunities. So that has now reversed, so that's the good news. But the supply side has to adjust, and it's taken a while to do it. And while the supply side is adjusting, housing prices and rents are rising, which is causing problems. But you know, they're good problems to have in a way, aren't they? It's better than the alternative of not being able to keep people and having kind of housing prices falling.
It is a good problem. Take some questions from the floor. Does anyone want to ask a question? If not, I know we've got a few online that we can go to while people are thinking about it. So I might go to an online question if I get that up again. And it's a question from Larissa Taylor. What indicators is the Reserve Bank seeing of the agriculture sector decarbonising through the COVID recovery and expansion?
I'm not, close enough to the details to be able to answer that, but I know it's an incredibly important issue. As I participate in many international meetings, often kind of late at night time, a very frequent question that comes up in those meetings is, what is Australian business doing to decarbonise? Many international investors are very focused on this issue, and it's particularly important for the agricultural sector because roughly 70% of agricultural output in Australia gets exported, so you're relying on overseas markets. And increasingly, overseas investors are asking about the carbon content of production. And that's a trend that's only going to continue. So Australian agriculture has tremendous opportunities here, but we need to find ways to disclose to global investors and global customers the decarbonisation strategy and how successfully we're doing it. So it's a really important issue, and it's going to become more important.
I might just get you to expand on that a little bit, because I know it's something that we were discussing last night at dinner about that disclosure aspect of the evidence base for decarbonisation, not just decarbonisation, but sustainability outputs more generally. How important is that, the evidence, the data of doing this, not just saying that we're doing it, but actually backing it up?
I think as the international focus increases on this issue, people are looking for stronger and more credible analysis and standardisation. I know in the area of finance where I work in, there are emerging templates where financial institutions and businesses will be expected to disclose their carbon footprint, and the international investment communities will be looking at those templates. And there's some convergence around one or two of these, and I think that's helpful. I don't know to what extent that the same convergence is occurring in agriculture, but we'll need, I think it's in our interest, to have some credible, widely accepted templates that we can use to demonstrate the carbon footprint. So I think we're going to have a good story to tell here, but we need a mechanism to tell it.
Thanks very much for your address, Ted Wilson. Just can you comment as to how well the government is handling productivity enhancing investment in infrastructure, things that well that you talked about in your address, the importance of productivity that we have in this region, inland rail, for example, that who was supposed to be running trains in 25, and we're talking 27 significant cost overruns just in those delays, and that's going to impact our capacity to be productive. So can you just talk to some of those investment, infrastructure investment decisions, just how well we are placed vis-a-vis our competitors, because out in the big blue ocean, we have people who want to eat our lunch, so how well are we going to be positioned?
Yeah. Well, it's not my job to comment on government policy. The government doesn't comment on monetary policy, and I don't offer running comment on government infrastructure policy and how well we're doing that. But I know the government has a strong focus on digital economy, on human capital, on education, on infrastructure. They're all incredibly important elements of future productivity growth. And we'll all have different views about how effectively that's been done, but I think they're the right areas. Digital, infrastructure, human capital, and I should add to that energy. And people will have different views on the government's energy policy. But I think they're the areas the government's focused on, and they're the right areas. Our population had been growing quickly. It's not grown quickly in the past year, but it's been growing quickly over time, so we need the infrastructure to support the higher levels of population. I imagine we'll go back, once COVID's finished, to stronger population growth again. So we need infrastructure. Investment in human capital, in education, is incredibly important as well. So Australia has become wealthy over the past 200 years, partly by what's in the ground and what can be grown in the ground, what you do. And that's going to be continue to be important. But increasingly important is what comes out of our heads, not what comes out of the ground. So investment in human capital, in education, in our university systems, in research and development, and the infrastructure that supports research and development, the commercialisation of that is important, and the government has that as a focus area as well. So I'm sorry I can't offer kind of comment on the particular projects, but they're the general areas. I think the government understands those.
Wilson, New South Wales Times. Just a question around investment. And you spoke about how there has been businesses investing, probably driven by the instant asset write-off with capital sales. Just wanted to delve in with the industry looking to grow a $100 billion industry and agri-futures having a report earlier in the year identifying that there is a big investment gap in agriculture. Just what do you think would be products to assist in getting that long-term investment? You spoke about bonds. Would that be something that could assist agriculture in being able to invest in the long-term, not just sort of short-term sugar hits?
No, at the end of the day, I don't think financing is the major issue here. If a business, a farm, has good ideas, good management, good technology, in the end, they can find some financing. It may be not that hard, not that easy. They might be a bit hard. They might have to go through a few different routes. But there is a very large pool of global savings and a large pool of Australian savings who are looking for home. So if you've got good ideas, good management, good technology, and a good business plan, there's money available. The reason we have low interest rates at the moment is that lots of people want to save, and not many businesses want to use those savings to invest in new capital. Now, people blame the central banks for the low interest rates, but we're really responding to this savings and investment dynamic. So there's plenty of money there. What we've got to see is good ideas, capacity and willingness to take risk, and good business plans. I'm confident if all those things are there, the money can be found.
We saw recently that New Zealand is looking to impose the debt-to-income ratios. Just looking at, obviously that will look to slow the housing market, just wondering if the RBA is firstly considering that, and secondly, if you were to consider that, do you think that would have implication in the regional areas more broadly?
Well, the Reserve Bank really doesn't control this area of policy. I mean, in New Zealand, the central bank does monetary policy and prudential supervision. As you know, here we have the Reserve Bank, and APRA does prudential supervision. As I said in my prepared remarks at the Council of Financial Regulators meeting last week, which I chair, we had a discussion about what might be the appropriate options to or employee if housing credit growth accelerated and was outstripping growth in incomes. So I don't think it's in the country's interest to have a extended period where credit growth is running way ahead of growth in our incomes, particularly given the high levels of debt. So we've worked through together with APRA what the options would be there, and they include looking at debt to income ratios, loan to value ratios, and the type of restrictions we saw a few years ago on investor and interest only lending as well. So we're not at the point where we're actively considering implementing any of initiatives in this area, but we're doing the preparation for what might happen, what we might do if credit growth was accelerating. Whether it would impact regional Australia more than the cities, I'm not sure. It would depend upon the nature of any particular restrictions that APRA introduced. We've got some way to go, though, before that's likely to happen.
Another online question, and then I'll come to another one from the floor. It's from Anthony Squires. Is the RBA concerned that short-dated government bonds trading at negative yields is a sign that QE cash injection is contributing to bond market dysfunction?
Not at all. The bond market's working well at the moment. There's a high level of liquidity. The bid-ask spreads are narrow. We're seeing at the short end of the yield curve, interest rates essentially zero, because there's a lot of liquidity in the system and people are looking for a home for that money. And when that happens, they look for government bonds, they force up the price of the government bond, and the yield comes down to zero. So it's a reflection of the plentiful liquidity in the system. And from my perspective, that plentiful liquidity means that banks have the capacity to lend, they have plenty of money, and the cost of finance for the banking system is very low as well. So it's all part of the strategy, and the bond market is working perfectly well at the moment.
Andrew, I think mainly in academia these days, but through you, Richard, Dr. Lowe, would you think that there's any likelihood of pressure on inflation as a result of the sort of unprecedented reduction in immigration which has taken place over the last 15, 18 months, and who knows what's going to happen in the next 12, 15 months? Thank you.
It's a good question. I think the main effect of the closure of the borders on the labour market is that we can no longer tap the overseas labour market for areas where workers are in short supply. So what used to happen before the pandemic is if there was a shortage in the labour market for a particular skill, firms could go overseas and tap the global labour market. And that meant that if there was very strong demand for workers of a particular skill, the price, the wage didn't really move very much because you could go and get workers from overseas. You can't do that at the moment, or at least it's very hard to bring in workers with skills. So it's not necessarily the level of immigration that's the main factor here. It's the ability to tap global labour markets for areas where there's a shortage of supply. And we're starting to hear reports of wages moving for some of those jobs. But as I said in my remarks, other firms are saying, well, we don't want to bid up the cost base now, because perhaps towards the end of the year there'll be a way to get workers to come back in with skills that we really need, and that'll alleviate some of the pressures. I think if that doesn't happen and we're still in this position in a year's time where we can't get workers, where skills are in short supply, I think we'll see more upward pressure on wages and inflation. So it's one of the uncertainties, how long it will be before we can once again tap global labour markets.
Thanks, Philip. I just wanted to understand this sort of remarkable reshape recovery, which was sort of, I guess, called the idea and now seems to have happened. Can you tease out the agriculture sort of apparently said the agriculture is called substantially recovering, we talked about 40% growth? Are you able to look back at that data and tell whether or not proportionally which has been a bit of a while, is it iron ore agriculture consumption all through, with a view of trying to understand how to achieve that recovery diet, because it still seems remarkable that that's happening, or we can perfectly turn off and go to and have our dealings with the world.
Well, the main driver of the recovery has been the bounce back in consumption. And it turns out that if you give people a lot of money and allow them to spend it, most of us spend it. You know, we save a bit, but we don't save it all. And what we've seen in Australia, the government give large amounts of money to both households and businesses. And once the health situation improved sufficiently that most of us could go about our lives relatively normally, we found ways to spend most of that money. People kept their jobs, so they had they're not worried about unemployment. So uncertainty declined, and we've spent a lot of that money sensibly. We've saved some of it, and that's a large part of the economic recovery. It's a positive story. The improvement in the agricultural sectors obviously helped as well. The recovery from the drought is a large part of that story, but the high prices globally is for food products is helping as well. So, but it's mainly the household sector being resilient and being prepared to change their patterns of spending. When people used to go overseas, they'd spend their money abroad. Now they don't do that. They're spending it domestically. So there's huge amounts of substitutability in what people are prepared to spend their money on. So many of the holiday destinations, I think in Queensland, I know in New South Wales, are very heavily booked as people have shifted their patterns of spending, and that's creating jobs here. The household sector have been remarkably resilient, and they've been prepared to change their patterns of spending. And the economies are the better for that.
Okay, please join me in thanking Dr. Rowe for this excellent presentation.
Thank you.